The homicide survivor deals with violent, sudden crime and death, and so the murder. It has to deal with this suddenness, and that's different because that changes the whole grief process.
Ruth Markell speaks from experience about her son, Dan Markell, the Florida law professor ambushed in a murder-for-hire plot, in a conspiracy that allegedly involves his ex-wife, who was a fellow law professor, and her brother and mother. You may think you have heard everything about this highly publicized case, but there is more. Hello, I'm Robert Riggs with a story from Inside the Crime Scene Tape about the murder victim's mother. During years of reporting, I witnessed the families of crime victims suffer, often in silence. No matter their race, religion, gender, socioeconomic, or public status, the trauma of homicide and violent crime leaves lifelong emotional scars on the families and friends of the victim. In my experience of covering wars and crimes, there is no such thing as closure for these painful losses. Ruth Markell says it's a life sentence that never ends. It began on a hot and muggy morning in Tallahassee, the capital of Florida, on Friday, July 18, 2014. 41-year-old Dan Markell, an internationally known criminal law professor at Florida State University, dropped his boys off at preschool, hit the gym, and returned home to his quiet, tree-canopied suburban neighborhood. A Prius rental car with two men inside followed Markell into his driveway. Before he could turn off the ignition, one of the men appeared at his driver's side window and pumped two 38 caliber rounds into his head. The hitmen had driven in from Miami, 10 hours away. The brazen daylight assassination marked the beginning of an 8-year murder investigation and prosecutions that will continue into 2023. As of December 2022, three accomplices in the murder-for-hire scheme have been convicted, allegedly hired by the family of Markell's ex-wife, Wendy Adelson, so she could move to Miami with the couple's children. Before the murder, the court denied Adelson's petition to move the children away from their father. Wendy Adelson was a 35-year-old clinical law professor at Florida State at the time of the murder. She looked like the stereotypical girl next door, tall and slim, shoulder-length brunette hair with blonde highlights, sparkling crystal blue eyes enhanced by colorized contacts, a big smile, rose-colored lipstick with a full lower lip, and pearly white teeth. The case appeared to have gone cold for 2 years until 2016. An FBI sting operation dubbed The Bump started to unravel the tangled web of a murder conspiracy. Luis Riviera, one of the gunmen, told FBI agents that he and his accomplice, Sigfredo Garcia, the trigger man, were hired for the hit because, quote, the lady wants her two kids back. Shortly after the murder of ex-husband, Wendy Adelson did move their children. Now, here's where it gets twisted, so stay with me. In his confession, Riviera told agents that Catherine Magbonawa was the go-between for the contract killing. At the time of the murder, Magbonawa was dating Wendy Adelson's brother, Charlie, and was a dental assistant in his office. The hitman, Sigfredo Garcia, was Magbonawa's ex-boyfriend and the father of their children. I told you it was twisted. In his mugshot, Adelson looked like he had just rolled out of bed, frizzy black hair, an unkempt Fu Manchu beard, and piercing hazel-colored eyes. 5 months later, his former girlfriend, Catherine Magbonawa, received a life sentence plus 60 years for her role in the murder. Luis Riviera testified that Magbonawa delivered a brown paper bag filled with $37,000 in cash to him shortly after the murder. The trial also included an incriminating conversation covertly recorded by the FBI at a Miami restaurant between McBonawa and her then-boyfriend, Charlie Adelson. Hundreds of wiretaps recorded the Ferrari-driving Fort Lauderdale periodontist and real estate investor bragging about peddling steroids, tax evasion, traveling overseas to cavort with young women, and his collection of automatic weapons. The investigation also revealed that Charlie Adelson and his sister Wendy had many powerful friends in political and judicial high places. At the time of the FBI sting, Wendy Adelson was working as a clerk in a federal court. Charlie Adelson is expected to stand trial for murder in early 2023. Wendy Adelson has not been charged with a crime. During McBonawa's murder trial, she denied that her contentious divorce led to Markell's killing. But Jeffrey LaCasse, her boyfriend at the time of the murder, testified Wendy would complain about Danny to anyone who would listen. She despised living in Tallahassee. She blamed Markell for her being stuck in Tallahassee, LaCasse said, adding that Wendy had told him that if anything ever happened to Danny, she would return to South Florida. LaCasse told the court that after Wendy's motion to relocate was denied, her brother Charlie had investigated multiple ways to eliminate the problem of Dan Markell, including hiring a hitman. That comment was made just 5 days before the contract murder occurred. Wendy Adelson moved to Miami a few days later and changed her son's last name to her maiden name. When the murder-for-hire scheme came to light in 2016, Wendy Adelson cut off Ruth and Phil Markell from seeing their two grandsons. In 2019, Ruth Markell turned her grief and anger into passing a law to support grandparents' visitation rights in Florida. House Bill 1119, dubbed the Markell Act, sponsored by Representative Jackie Toledo and Senator Keith Perry, gave grandparents a path to seek visitation rights if a civil or criminal court finds a parent culpable of the other parent's death. Ruth Markell has written a book about her tragic journey to inspire and encourage crime victims. It's titled The Unveiling, A Mother's Reflection on Murder, Grief, and Trial Life. Here's our interview. Ruth Markell, thank you for joining the True Crime Reporter podcast to share the story of what you're still going through over the murder of your son, Dan Markell. It's been my experience in covering murder cases that the victim's family is often just forgotten in the process. What's been your experience?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me, and even more thank you for acknowledging that the victim family is lost. So I'm from Canada, I should tell you that, and actually this is a small Canadian write-up, and the best description that I've heard yet, which I'll get into my own, is the victim is the orphan of the criminal system. So thank you for certainly focusing on this.
That is so true. And I know that you have stated that it's a life sentence that never ends.
This is true. The one thing that I think is so important to understand is the whole experience of the homicide survivor. I can go into a little bit of a description because this is really, I'm so happy we're starting on the victim experience because I'm really trying to create a sensitivity to what happens to the victim in the whole process of dealing with the homicide. And there's two types of descriptions that I'm really wanting our audiences to know about. I'll talk about my book, which is Lifting the Veil, the Unveiling, but it's to show this whole victim experience. And the one experience, which is called a homicide survivor, which is very different than other kinds of loss and trauma. And a homicide survivor deals with violent, sudden crime and death. And so the murder, it has to deal with this, the suddenness, and that's different because that changes the whole grief process. The second part of anybody who's going through a homicide and their victim is now the criminal system, and they're separate. One is psychological, and the part I'm going to explain now is legal. And the victim actually has rights within the criminal system in Florida. Now, this is where my late son, Dan Markell, was murdered. There is even something called Marcy's Law, which was passed in 2019, which does give the victim several rights as they're going through the criminal process. What is unique about the trauma of a homicide experience and the impact on the family is the interaction between the psychological trauma, being the homicide survivor, and the victim in the criminal system.
Yes. Let me take you back, because I want our listeners to understand what crime victims' families go through, because you're also a huge victim in this process. And also, the media throws around this term closure. It's my experience that that means nothing. There's never closure. Everybody I've dealt with, and also I was in Iraq embedded and was, there were troops around us that didn't come home. There was never closure for their families. It's always there. Take me back to when you first received the notification that your son Dan had been assassinated, murdered in his driveway.
Yes, this was really, really very difficult for all of us. I will just go back a little bit and talk about Dan, because I think, I'm not sure if your listeners had any highlighted background on who he was. Dan Markell, who's known as the slain professor in Florida, and I'm known as the mother of the slain professor in Florida, but he's Canadian. And he lived in Canada until he left to go to undergrad in Harvard. Harvard, obviously in Boston. Later on, he went to Harvard Law School, and he went to England and to Israel to study, and he received many, many degrees. He's very well known because he also started a blog called Prof's Blog, which was for young legal students. And this gave him international acclaim, which does resolve in certain situations into this whole murder story. In addition to that, he was the best father there could be. And I was most proud of him, actually, as a father. And he would go to the daycare center and read to the children all the different holidays. So this is just sort of who was Dan, because I think Dan, really, the background here certainly discusses and highlights, the impact of how we found out. Dan was shot in the morning, 11 o'clock, on July 14th, 2014. And because we're in Canada, I don't know, because they couldn't find us, but in any way, they found us, if you want to call it, through Facebook. Our first contact was actually not with the police, but I was contacted from the hospital where Dan's friends from the university, at that time, Dan worked for Florida State University, FSU, and his friends were able to go to the hospital because, Tallahassee is a small town in relative terms. Like, everybody knew him and, the spinning started that he was shot. So they went to the hospital where he was taken. And this is university colleagues and friends. And they called us finally. They got us. And the first call that I actually got, other than from his father, was from the rabbi, because now Dan was affiliated with different Jewish organizations, was from the rabbi at the Chabad, one of the synagogues. And he told me, he almost like what you would call last rites. He had just been there. And then he put me on with an emergency doctor. So my first contact was actually not law enforcement at all, but an emergency doctor. And the emergency doctor described the situation, and he told me that they didn't expect Dan to make it later than 2 o'clock the next morning, like 2 a.m. On the 15th, which is exactly what happened. So we actually didn't have, just to answer your initial point of questioning, we didn't have a law enforcement communication because they were looking for us. And it came in, really in a different way. And then following that, we did go to Tallahassee the next day. And because we're now leaving, I'm leaving from Toronto. I had to get back. I was in Montreal. I had to get back to Toronto to get my passport. I mean, the logistics behind the scenes were really something. And when we arrived, to deal with your question about law enforcement, which actually was a little bit like the next Sunday morning, they were very, very empathetic, and they introduced you know, themselves, and they drove us around and, you know, kind of really nurtured us in a, I don't mean in a food way, but in a supportive way. And we were then escorted everywhere we needed, because at that time, nobody knew what this murder case was about. So there was two parts to it. You know, they didn't imply that they thought that our safety was at hand, but they were very, very cautious.
And once you learned the details of how he was murdered, did you suspect anyone at that point?
Not me. I didn't. I thought, cause, you know, Danny had this prof's blog that I mentioned. Others did. I didn't. So I went with this idea that, so he had this prof's blog, and I actually told the police that they should look on it, because previous 2-3 weeks earlier, and I had just by fluke been looking at it, somebody had an, I would call it a dispute with Dan, because they felt maybe that he edited some of their comments or something. It was more like he was the leader, you know, the founder and so forth, and something of that tone. So I was very open to maybe that being a source. I didn't consider it as a student, you know, taking out any vengeance, which there were all these like hypotheses at the beginning. So I didn't go right away to sort of say that who I thought could have done it, where many people did state who they thought were at the very beginning.
And were you aware that he was in a contentious custody battle at the time?
Very aware, yes. It was really, you know, it wasn't, you know, what I would call the literal, everybody calls it a custody battle. Custody itself, they had an arrangement, it's 50-50. They had a very big, major difference. His ex-wife, Wendy Adelson, and they had a very big difference on two big issues. One was a sort of religious preferences, how to bring up the children, which wasn't originally going in the marriage. That was, they had agreement on. But the next one, which was the big piece at the time of his murder, was about the family of Wendy. And she and herself at that time, this is now post-divorce, very close to the proceedings of the divorce, wanted to move to South Florida with her parents. And it was that relocation issue that spurred, you know, all of the major disputes and I will call it my earthquake and everything else further, you know, from those moments on.
And when do you begin to realize, and the people around you, that there was a conspiracy to murder your son? That there were hitmen hired?
Right. So we didn't know that right away. There was people who did believe right away that, well, I should say two things. It wasn't random. At the Sunday morning when we met with our first time we ever met the law enforcement, go back to your question, they already knew this was not random and this was not, you know, a theft. Nobody went into the house. Everything happened in the driveway, like, you know, the entrance of the garage, so to speak. So there was no question that this was certainly not a you know, random shooting or anything like that. And then following that, actually, we didn't know a lot for quite a while. It took a year until the police anniversary of Dan's first year that he was murdered, when they announced that they had a car. And it was really from that car, and that was really lucky. The neighbor, his name is Geiger, was the one who really saw a white or green Prius in the driveway. That was the only clue that they had for a whole year. And it was really based on that they started tracking this Prius and looking, searching the license. They weren't able to get it exactly, but there were damages on the car, which allowed them to be able to say, okay, this is the car, so to speak. And they tracked it, you know, with the sun pole. It's amazing when you see how they do the tracking. They use all of the regular buses on the street, the cameras in the people's homes and so forth. So that was really the beginning of how they were going to really determine, you know, kind of where they could even go to figure out who murdered him. And that took a while. So nobody knew it's a murder for hire for 2 years. Like, we didn't have any of that information until Garcia, who was considered the shooter, Zagfredo Garcia, who was arrested in 2016, in May 2016.
And during this 2-year period. Did you ever become concerned that the case has been forgotten, it's a cold case, we'll never know, or did the police keep you informed?
The first year was hard. The first year, you know, we sort of divided up after the reality of, you know, this is a murder, a death, and so forth. I had the portfolio, let's say, within the family of communicating with law enforcement. My daughter, Shelby, has a lot of stuff to do at the beginning, all the finances, and Phil got it, and Phil Dan's father, you know, they got involved with the estate issues, right? So we sort of separated our portfolio, which is really what it was. And I had law enforcement, but there was nothing. The first year was really very, very quiet.
In 2016, the FBI sting broke the case wide open. Ruth Markell and her family faced the murder trial of the hitmen who were paid to kill her son. Markell is a sophisticated business management consultant, but nothing prepared her for a criminal courtroom. She says it was a terrifying experience.
It is. It's a foreign process. It's a foreign language even before one of the things I talk about is that the victim should be given more, let's call it language before, you know, the jury even gets 12 pages of guidelines. The victims don't get anything. The first trial, I should say, was not with Luis Rivera. It was with Fredo Garcia and Catherine McBanua. They decided to join their trial in September 2019. And that was the first trial because Luis Rivera had already, let's call it, plea bargained and brought in Catherine McBanua, whose arrest came in October, when theirs came in May and June of 2016. So the trial, we had so many cancellations, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, The Unveiling, you know, A Mother's Reflection on Grief, Murder, and the Trial Life. And it's particularly this part about the waiting and the uncertainty and what it feels like, you know, to be in the trial room and see actually the offenders, you know, for the first time. So the trial is a very, very emotionally difficult situation, experience altogether. And it's besides seeing the two people in front of you, in this case, it was Garcia and Catherine, they dress them up, you know, like as we've seen in all these trials, they're wearing a suit, they're wearing glasses, you know, so it neutralizes a little bit the impact that the actual murderer is right sitting in front of you. You still feel it. I was more anxious before entering into the trial room. And then in the trial room, I saw them and then you see the jury. And there's a lot of other things that just create this larger impact than just, you know, sitting in the room with the people who potentially murdered your son. But it's a horrific experience. Like the whole thing is very, very disturbing. And it's disturbing not just in the moments of the 3 weeks of the trial. It lingers later. I mean, people who have mentioned before about the closure, the life sentence, this doesn't go away. These images are in your head. You know, when you hear all the evidence and you go through it all and you... Certain people who are witnesses, you really hope that they're going to do a good job. Like when Luis Rivera was a key witness, the first trial that I went to, I was like, couldn't go out with anybody for dinner afterwards because I was so worried that he had to be credible. He was a key witness.
When you saw them all freshened up, dressed up, do you, as the victim, feel like this is a sham? They're trying to fool the jury here.
Right, for sure. They do that anyway. but image-wise, for sure, because if I'm the parent, can feel a little neutralized, you know, like from the fact about who these people really are, for the jury, it's the facade, for sure, of everything. And the jury has also the people, because, you know, the defense team sits, obviously, and there were two defense teams because Garcia had one defense team in this trial in September 2019, and Catherine McBanua had another defense team. And then there's, of course, the prosecutor and her group. So there's a lot of, and I don't mean this, in all my two children and their spouses at the time were all lawyers. But what I'm going to say is there's a lot of lawyerly looks, right, in the room. And if they dress up Catherine in a suit, and the same thing with Garcia, and they're at the same tables. It's a big distraction. And that's what I think they're doing it for, obviously, the jury.
Just a sort of a subtle trying to make them think that they're good people, responsible citizens.
That's what it is. Yeah. It's a big manipulation.
Well, you've really, Dan's family's really been dragged through it here because this has been an 8-year process. Charlie Adelson, the brother of Wendy, the ex, has been arrested, has not been tried yet, and no charges have been filed against Wendy. What has that been like, that long process of waiting and wondering if will everyone be brought to justice?
That's the hard part, and it's also very hard because, you know, this is a case that has big P politics in it, and from the very beginning, there we talk about law enforcement, there was definitely major differences. So this is the big P politics between the state attorney office and, of course, the Tallahassee Police Department, the FBI, in terms of who should have been brought in on day one, right? So the controversy starts at the beginning of the arrest. That everybody, this is now I'm talking about the public and other people, that all of the people who potentially were involved in the murder for hire should have been brought in day one, whenever there were arrests. So you have all the time this kind of, it's more than what you see on TV, you know, the back and forth between the police and the state attorney or whoever they're working with, the feds, whatever. But this is major, and the difference is always present. So this is hard because you're not only waiting and you want to know really what's going to happen. And then when so many people were actually named, so Charlie Adelson's arrest, which happened just now in 2022 on April 21st, was considered really for many people just the start of the case, although we've been through many, many hearings and many, many trials. But so this is really where the anticipation is very high.
When the conspiracy to murder law professor Dan Markell came to light in the FBI sting operation, his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson, cut off contact to Ruth Markell's grandsons.
One of the things that happened when we were cut off right away from seeing the children in 2016, we were cut off for six years. And at the time that we were cut off, one of our supports is expertise from a firm in New York called Gibson and Dunn. And they told me at the time, the lawyer who we worked with, Matthew Benjamin, said, Ruth, you're going to have to write a bill. I'm sitting in Toronto. How am I going to write a bill in Florida? And then all my other friends started, Ruth, you're going to have to get lobbyists and so forth. So I had this in my head. Why I wanted to tell you this, I'm backtracking, is this is so important for victim families. Many times they want to do something to memorialize their child or their loved one, and they sit on it. They become a little bit immobilized. And that's one of the reasons I want to talk about this. It was only after Garcia's trial in 2019. So what I'm telling you now is why I'm saying it is I sat for 3 years with this information because I wasn't ready yet, because I was committed to the criminal system, if you understand.
Yes.
I couldn't take another foot off the sort of emotional input to the criminal part of the case. As soon as Garcia was convicted, it loosened up for me a lot of energy. And then I met somebody, her name is Karen Halpern-Cyphers, who started to do the grandparent legislation. She met me in Tallahassee right at the end of the trial. And she says she was a friend of Ben's. What can I do for you? And I just yelled that I was like, grandparent alienation. And we started. And that's how the bill, HB 1119, and that's informally known as the Markell Act, was passed. It took us 3 years, too, actually, to do that. But it's a phenomenal success. And thank you for bringing it up.
And have you been able to see your grandsons now as a result of that act?
Yes, and not directly from the act, but indirectly. So what happened, we saw them once. What happened was Catherine McBanna was trial for February 26th or so, 19th, I think was the first day, 2022, was postponed after this enhancement of the Dolce Vita restaurant and the wiretapping, and then was set for May 16th. And Wendy, in February, now this is just after the House passed the bill and the Senate passed it 50-50, wrote me an email. I haven't heard from her for 6 years in terms of, you know, seeing the children or that kind of contact. I had one communication with her just before the trial of 2019, but this is now, she's inviting us all, when I say all, that means Shelley and her family, to a bar mitzvah for Benjamin, who's her son, turning 13. And she wants us to attend, and she's made the date of the bar mitzvah just May 14th, just before the May 16th trial. So that worked, you know, in terms of how she appears at the trial. She could say she has seen us and so forth. Anyway, we said yes, of course, we were like delighted. And then what happened was I said, you know, let's go for ice cream the day before. And she then wrote me back, look, if you want an in-person visit with the kids, come in April. And we grabbed it. So Phil and I went down in April and we saw the children April 20th. This is an amazing story. We had a very, very good and successful visit with them. We get back on the plane and the next morning, 6 a.m., I get a call from the FBI. Charlie Adelson is arrested. So in 24 hours, we had the biggest breakthrough in this, in our personal lives. We see the children and the breakthrough in the case is really phenomenal. So that was 2022 has just been a very good beginning year, you know, of sort of consolidating a few of the outstanding concerns.
Do you have a sense of what kind of toll it has taken on these boys who've lost their father and this controversy swirls around it?
Oh, that's my biggest fear. If I, you know, take away all of the stuff, the criminal system, you just hit it on the nail. I'm really worried about their mental health. I don't know what they know really now. I think since Charlie's arrested, this is, I don't know this factually, but I'm gathering thoughts about it. They have to know more. I think they were extremely protected before, and it's going to be a tough toll. And I'm very nervous to be out, you know, what are you going to do when you wake up one day and you see, you know, who potentially, I'm not going to say factually, we don't know yet, who potentially could have murdered your father? It's frightening.
The book is The Unveiling, A Mother's Reflection on Murder, Grief, and Trial Life. What is the meaning of the title? You have a meaning in the title.
I do have a very good meaning, and I'm glad you asked. Okay, so The Unveiling actually has two very strong meanings. One of them is the part in the Jewish religion after a funeral takes place, somewhere between, families choose different time frames, but anyway, anywhere from 30 days to an 11-month period, you have what's called an unveiling. So it's a service. And the service is, you normally at the gravesite, it's not completed until you put a tombstone on the gravesite. And the tombstone in general in the Jewish religion usually has a very large inscription on it, and it's covered with a piece of fabric until you have the actual ceremony or ritual when you're going to invite other people and have special prayers. And that's called the unveiling, where you lift the curtain, you lift this piece of fabric off, and everybody can see what is happening in terms of this inscription. But why I chose the title is not only for that part of the ritual, but more specifically, that's when I started my grief process. And I talk a lot about grief because I think it's such an important topic to identify. Before, and this is 9 months after I had, before I was in a daze, I had shock, I had an out-of-body experience at the later part in 3 months and so forth. I even had some illness, but the grief that started, you know, it's the expression, putting the nail in the coffin. So the actual fact that there's a tombstone layered on top of a gravesite was the finality for me. That's one reason. It's a bit of the personal journey about grief, but the second is more important too. It's to lift the curtain to the public. And this is what I'm doing. I want the public to understand, what is the victim experience? What are we going through? Let's follow us through the trial life. follow us, as in my case, we're not even anywhere finished, right? We're in a murder for hire. It's going to be more years. And still involvement, you identified at the beginning. It is a life sentence. There is no closure. And what is happening to the family as we're going through this? And it's particularly important now with all the school shootings. I mean, I'm not alone in this, right? There's a lot of families who are suffering. They're suffering between, you know, the impact of the loss on them, and they're suffering because of the fact that they're going to be experiencing the criminal system of which they have no previous preparation for. So that's the reason it's called The Unveiling. And thank you for asking, because it's a very important part of why the book is written.
Well, God forbid that one of our listeners someday finds himself in your shoes with a tragedy like this. But based on your experience, can you give me some high-level advice of what they should do and how to try to handle it, how to live through it, and how to channel their anger?
Yes, I can. I think that's important. I think, yes. And everybody's going to do things at different times. And I think that's the most important thing to recognize. What's very good today in today's times of how we see grief and so forth and mourning, there isn't a rush, because people, you know, earlier on used to talk about, you know, they had 6 weeks to, you know, and I myself, my first career is a social work. I also went for an MBA type, so I had a business type of background. But my point is, there's no limit there. You don't feel you have to have, you know, get over the grief like by tomorrow morning or 6 weeks or a year, and especially with the criminal system. It's not going to happen. So that's another important point. However, in one of the recent podcasts, and I just said this spontaneously, is don't get lost in the loss, L-O-S-S. So don't get L-O-S-T in the loss. So even although you're in deep, deep grief, allow yourself to take very small steps. One of the most important steps is don't isolate yourself. And I had somebody give me very good advice at the very beginning, emotional advice. Somebody who I wouldn't call her like a long-term friend, but certainly she was an acquaintance that could share. And she, her son had just committed suicide, I think a previous 6 months before my story. And I said to her, you know, here I am, I just lost a son. I said, you know, do you have anything you want to share with me? And she said, and it's very good advice, she said, take all the calls from the beginning, because you don't always know that they're going to be there later. So in other words, don't isolate yourself. And I did that. Luckily for me, my calls still come. But that's a very important part. The other thing is, anybody who's suffering, you need to have, it's not just reduce your isolation, but get support from the clergy, from therapists, from friends, and so forth. And then the real big thing now is, like someone like myself, when I'm moving on a little bit in terms of, you know, not in the deepest part of my grief, still very deep and very meaningful, but I'm able to sort of lift a little bit, I would say you have to redefine yourself and find meaning. And that's important. And for me, the grandparent, the book too, but the book, you know, people ask me, is the book so cathartic? The real answer is not so much, because I'm still going through the criminal system. I'm waiting right now for a trial date. But the effect of the success in something like the grandparent legislation, I think is really important. So the other major advice is redefine yourself, whatever that may be. And if you're thinking about memorializing your child or a loved one, because it has to always be children, the children obviously take the worst out of you. So then I would say that, you know, like take those small steps to search out what you're thinking that you want to do, and try to get to it, because that will help too. So redefine yourself.
Well, the one thing that strikes me is that you became an advocate for change, especially with the Markell Act. Is that what you would suggest
now
to other
victims? Well, now I'm on a new agenda, truthfully, a combined agenda with victims' rights. I would like to do legal education where lawyers can have what I call, you know, sensitivity to compassion. I'm actually doing some speaking right now with different, you know, organizations and healthcare groups and so forth of how to help people. Listen, the school shootings, Plus, you have COVID. Okay, COVID deaths in the States, you know that the statistics are well over a million by now. It's huge. So what I'm saying is so many families are suffering. And whatever it is that you're concerned with, you know, I would say try to either regroup if you want to do advocacy, if you want to do charity, if you just want to memorialize on a very personal level, you know, kind of take those steps. Those are the small steps, but they just lift you and they start to get you in the right direction.
Ruth Markell, thank you for sharing what you've learned going through this tragedy. The book is The Unveiling, A Mother's Reflection on Murder, Grief, and Trial Life. This is very, very enlightening to me as a reporter, because I've seen so many victims. Sometimes the victims stuck on a bench outside the courtroom, outside the trial, within earshot of the killer's family. So there's still so much that needs to be done, but thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity. And of course, happy holidays and enjoy the nice seasons that are coming towards us right now.
We want to be your favorite true crime podcast. So please recommend us to your friends and leave a review wherever you listen. If you want to receive updates and bonus interviews, join our true crime community at truecrimereporter.com. If you have suggestions or know of a case that we should look into, email us at fan@truecrimereporter.com. This podcast is a trademarked and copyrighted news organization based in Dallas, Texas. You can read more about our news team at truecrimereporter.com. Thanks for listening to our Journey into Darkness.